Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening, everyone. I want to welcome you all to another episode of the Real Talk with Chris Richardson Show. Again, I'm your host, Chris Richardson. I'm delighted, excited, and tonight's a very, very special night. And well, you are in. I know we're competing with the Game 5 of the Golden State game versus the Cleveland Cavaliers. But look, if you're listening to this, whether it's going to be live or you're listening on a podcast, you're certainly in for a treat tonight. And I want to just thank you again for, you know, really taking time out of your busy schedules to listen. Now, tonight's show is going to probably go from 9 to 10, but if we go over a little bit, it's going to be okay because it's going to be worth the while. So those of you who are first-time listeners, I want to welcome you all to the show. This show is real simple. It's about helping people live better, love deeper, and laugh more. We always say, when you are better, we are better. What does that mean? That means simple. When you can be a better husband, better wife, better mother, better brother, sister, aunt, uncle, everything. You are better when you get the help that you need. Now, tonight's show is very, very, very important. We're going to talk about family secrets and how do you overcome them, and I've got my special guest. You're going to hear from her in just a few minutes, but I want to tell you this is a show that is real important, that if you hear something and that you feel that there is a kind of an urge or a frustration or an emotion that you can't explain, I'm going to tell you off the break, it's time to get professional help, okay, just off the top, because I forewarn you in advance, we may open up a little bit, we may peel some things back, and for some, this may be a little deeper than you've ever thought about. You're talking about a topic about family secrets and things of that nature, it could potentially kind of like strike a nerve, you know what I mean, or just kind of rub you the wrong way. So again, this is a full disclaimer. Get professional help from the area that you are in. Seek that by a psychologist professional that is licensed as a practitioner in that particular area. So having said that, I get the distinct honor and the pleasure and the privilege of introducing tonight's special guest, Nicole Wright, and she is out of sight. She is a professional, number one, licensed clinical social worker. She's the owner of executive director of Gifted Hands Wellness Center, LLC. She's got over 18 years of experience working with individuals, couples, and families on a broad spectrum of issues. She's trained as a therapist in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, a psychological treatment model designed to treat post-traumatic stress and related emotional and behavioral problems in children as well as adolescents. The model may also be adapted for use with adults, so that's significant as well. So in addition to TF-CBT, Nicole uses a variety of such as cognitive behavioral therapy, play therapy, and brief social-focused therapy to help clients heal from their past, restore balance in their lives, and achieve their goals. So after the broadcast, we will open it up a little bit later, but first and foremost, I want to welcome you all again. In any event that you are listening live, well, we got to post a group chat session that will be going on live inside Facebook. So simply log into your Facebook page. You can go to the Real Talk with Chris Richardson Show and join the Facebook group. It's a private, elusive, exclusive group, as a friend of mine once would say. But it's important because there you'll have an opportunity to post your questions. Some of you may want to remain anonymous, and that's quite okay as well. You can send me an email at chris@realtalkwithchrisrichardson.com if you choose to remain anonymous with your question. And if you want to share a question tonight, you can call in, absolutely, 619-924-0869. Again, that's 619-924-0869. And when you dial in, all you have to do is press 1. Now, last thing I'm going to say, and I'm going to get out of the way and play some music here, we have one housekeeping rule, and that's really simple. We can agree to disagree. That's it. We can agree to disagree. That's right. So that means that there's no right answer necessarily or any wrong. We can simply say, hey, we can challenge the message, but we never attack the messenger. It's just that simple. So having said all that, I'm going to play a little music, and we'll be right back. And the next voice that I'll introduce and bring in will be none other than Nicole Wright herself. Hang in there. Hold on just a second.
I didn't want to lose my crown.
Well, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And again, I want to thank you all for tuning in. I see we've got some new listeners tuning in for the very first time, and just want to give shout outs to you. And for those of you who are listening online, shout outs to you as well. And I want to thank you once again. Tonight's topic, as you just heard Babyface say, it's, we're talking about secrets. And many of us, in fact, we're talking about family secrets. And many of us have secrets. And there's not a person probably on the face of this earth that doesn't have a family secret. Some are bigger than others. However, we're going to get into that tonight. And again, I said I would get out of the way, and I'm going to bring in a professional now, none other than Nicole Wright herself. Nicole, can you hear me?
I sure can. Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited that you are here, too, as well, and I'm certain that the listeners will be blessed by the information that you will share without a shadow of a doubt. So let's jump right in. Are you ready to roll?
Sure am.
Well, folks, this is going to be exciting. I encourage you to share with a friend. This is one of those that you want to replay and repodcast or retweet, whatever. Tonight, tell a friend, tell a neighbor that Nicole Wright herself is the licensed clinical therapist, and she is on the show to talk about family secrets. How do you overcome them? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Now, this is not the show, as I prefaced earlier. It's not the show about self-medicating. We don't want to do that tonight. So we're going to give some things, but we're going to stay away from going into what we call practicing therapy, although she is licensed. We're not going to do the model itself. We're just going to share some things on the surface because you got to invest in that. And so we'll leave that to the end when Nicole will share her information. But let's jump right into it. Nicole, as a therapist, you treated a variety of clients for various issues, I'm sure, over time. So, however, I'm willing to bet that this has probably got to be like the top, certainly one of the top five topics that you deal with. Is that true?
Well, everyone doesn't call it a secret, but in one way or another, it may be. And so, I mean, I think it's pretty standard to expect that, you know, as individuals, we have things that happen in our lives. Some we choose, some we don't choose. Some things that we feel good about and some things we don't feel so good about. And those things that we don't feel so good about, typically, we don't talk about them a lot. And part of the reason we don't talk about them is because we have just a variety of different feelings that are associated with those conversations. And then over time, those things become what one might call a secret or a family secret or just something that what I hear a lot of my clients say is, you know, I just don't talk about it too much. So they may not specifically call it a secret, but in the end, by definition, it's sort of just trying to keep others from knowing something, keep something hidden, one could define it as a secret.
Yeah, and that's, now, folks, what we're talking about, we can kind of broaden this out just a little bit. We're going to cover a couple different bases. We're going to define in the next few questions for Nicole, she'll share what really is mental health. So when we think about family secrets, though, and it's pretty broad, and I'm just going to list just a few of them from childhood stories related to adoption, who's my real mama, who's my real daddy, molestation, drug and alcohol abuse, whether it's pornography, marriage issues, and the what-if account, on and on and on. We could go on to it. So, Nicole, let's break this down in practical bite-sized pieces for the people and kind of unpack this thing a little bit. So, first off, what is mental health, and what are the various issues that a mental health professional might treat today?
So that term mental health sounds really, really loaded and very scary for a lot of people. And I think that's probably because there's so much unknown in what is mental health. But really, it's just simply a wide range of conditions that affect a person's mood, their thinking, their behavior. And it can look very different for different people. And even individuals with the same sort of air quotes of diagnosis, the behaviors, the manifestation can look very different. So two people don't necessarily present in the exact same way. The ones that, you know, I guess seem to get a lot of attention or give a lot of people anxiety about what does this mean, is that anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, Those are the ones that you more commonly hear today, but there are a wide range of mental health conditions, and they range in severity and how it manifests in a from one individual to another.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, folks, to just to understand, as we kind of go a little bit deeper now. We're going to pull this onion back just a little bit more. So, Nicole, when it comes to selecting a mental health professional, someone's out there that's listening right now and saying, you know, I've been kind of feeling a certain way. I just can't explain these untriggered emotions. What should a prospective client know? And how do you choose the right professional for their need?
So the first step is to honestly make the call. And that's probably the toughest thing for someone to do, is to just get started and make the call. Once you make the call, the process of identifying a good fit somewhat happens at times pretty naturally. And I try from the very beginning, from the very first conversation, to instill a sense of competency and the ability to decide what is best for themselves in my clients pretty immediately, even before they even become my clients, that in that conversation, I let them know that it's okay and it is the right thing to do to determine if I or someone else is a good fit for them. Because in therapy, for it to really work, you do spend some time talking about things that don't always feel good. And so you have to feel comfortable with the person. And so, you know, I encourage my clients to trust their gut, phone, listen to the inflection in my voice or the person's voice, pay attention to how much time they'll spend with you on the phone to answer your questions. When you go to the office setting, pay attention to the environment. Do you feel comfortable? Is it inviting? And if there is any degree of uncertainty, to ask questions, that is completely okay. It's kind of like when you're picking a doctor, any other kind of doctor, and, you know, you're looking for office hours. Can they meet your schedule? Is the front desk receptionist friendly? Do they pick up the phone when you call? Do they call you back when they say they're going to call back? What the environment is like? Is it clean? Is it inviting? All of those things matter. All of those things go into increasing comfort level. And my goal is to increase comfort level and to reduce tension. So if I'm able to get the person's comfort level up, they're more likely to really get honest with themselves and with me and talk about the issues that are bothering them so that they can ultimately move on with their lives without me.
And so speaking of the move on part and the diagnosis, before you get into choosing the therapist, I always see different credentials. And so I'm sure, break that down. Is there a difference between specialization and credentialing for therapists?
Absolutely. It's, again, just, you know, you have your different types of doctors. You have your primary care and you have your gastro. In the field of counseling, you know, you have licensed professionals, counselors, and they have their own set of academic studies and credentialing licensure process. I happen to be a licensed clinical social worker, which is different from a psychologist. So, for example, I don't do any kind of psychological testing. I don't interpret psychological testing for my clients. And then, you know, you have psychiatrists who are actually medical doctors, and they write prescriptions. You also have nurse practitioners who work in the mental health field. So there's a variety of health professionals who can provide an array of services. And then in terms of specialization, it really just suggests sort of the topic areas or the population that an individual may work best with. So, for example, there's some individuals who really just prefer and work best with children. And so they may not take a lot of adults. There are some individuals who only work with adults. And so it's really about, you know, the professionals' preferences, their aptitude, their training, their area of study, all of that factors into specialization.
Yeah, and I think that's real important to know for a listener, to just take your time with the process. What's really important is to get help. That's the significant part, like Nicole said, just simply get help. And I think that's really mm-hmm. important. So, Nicole, let's as we say, we're going to peel this layer back just a little bit more now, because you want to kind of let the listeners feel comfortable with this process, because for some, this is uneasy. This is uncharted territory.
Right.
This is where some folks are just like, they're really unsure, uncertain. And so we really want to make this comfortable for you, just really as a conversation. So that's why I'm trying to peel the layer back, just to take it easy through the approach of this, make sure we give you the right information kind of to ease you into it and let you know that mental health, or whatever you want to call it, it is about, really, it's about just living and loving from the inside out. That's really what it's all about. It's learning to love yourself from the inside out so that you can feel good about yourself and deal with others. And Nicole always said this, the way people treat others is a direct reflection of how they really truly feel about themselves.
I think that there's a lot of truth to that statement. And but then there's also a lot of people, I mean, I encounter individuals in my practice on a regular basis who they're excellent at taking care of others. They go out of their way to make sure that other people's needs are taken care of, and often at the neglect of their own. So, I mean, sometimes you have the flip side of that as well.
Right. Right, absolutely. That's true. So how do you define, let's get into this family secret thing. So how do you really define a secret?
So, you know, I don't really use that word too much in stigma and lots of negative feelings that go along with secret when you're talking about it in the terms of a therapeutic setting. So, you know, when I work with my clients, I ask them if there is something that has happened in their life that they might not feel comfortable sharing, or they don't talk about a lot, or that a lot of people don't know about. And then I give them permission, because sometimes some people feel like their lives are so much out of their control, like everything is sort of happening to them and they can't seem to get control, that I try to give them back some of that control. And so I'll say to them, to the extent that you're able, can you tell me about whatever this thing is that you don't talk about? Or I'll say, at any point, if this becomes too much for you to share or to give details, or if I'm asking too many questions and it's becoming too difficult for you, let me know. For some people who have a lot of anxiety issues, right up front will sort of identify like a code that they can give me that I'll be able to read without them telling me. So it might be, you know, a tap on the side of their face, or they rub their hands, or something that they can cue me in that it's becoming too much so I can interpret their body language. Kind of how we build rapport. We build comfort through that, and we get to a place where an individual feels like they can talk about that taboo sort of subject that they don't like to talk about too much.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like, a lot of, as you just kind of stated, a lot of your clients are trying to find that comfort zone for themselves. It's new. It's kind of euphoric, and there's a whole lot of anxiety that they're probably dealing with at the time, just coming to see you to begin with, because they don't really know what they don't know. For many. So, you know, in your part as a professional, you've got to be highly in touch with the insensitive, because I'm sure a lot of the folks are dealing with a lot of emotional scars or, you know, thoughts that they may not be comfortable with. So as a therapist, where do you really begin? You've said a lot of things, but where do you begin with this process? And how do you treat a client with these kind of concerns?
So at the very first session, that session is usually called like an intake or an information gathering session. I kind of liken it for my clients, like when you go to the doctor for the first time and they're seeing you for the first time, they collect a lot of historical information. They want to know about your family history. They want to see if there are any kind of medical conditions that they need to be paying attention to, or predisposition to anything. And so in that first session, I do gather a lot of information. And I tell the client that I ask a lot of questions in that first session. And so that begins to paint a little bit of a picture. And with some of the questions that I ask, based on their response, based on their body language, based on the silence, probe a little bit more, depending on what I'm getting back for the individual, I may not. After about 2-3 or so sessions in, and I feel like we're not really making some headways, you know, I'm honest with the client, and I'll say, you know, I feel like there's something that you're not saying that I need to know, and I'm not really sure how to help you with this if I don't know what we're dealing with. And so I'll say, is there something that you need from me to help you feel more comfortable in sharing? Is there a question that you need to ask that will make you feel like it's okay to talk about this? And so at some point I have to say to the client, if I really think that it is impeding their ability to go further and get to where they ultimately want to be, which is folks come in because they want to leave feeling better. They don't want to leave the same way that they came in. And so with that goal in mind, and we typically agree on that up front, that there are times when I will say, particularly if I'm able to pick up on it in our conversation, I will ask the question and say, you know, this seems like there's something you're not saying. And so can we talk about that a little bit? Can I ask you some questions? And then we take it from there.
Yeah, I think that's really important, just building that, as you say, rapport and setting the bond. Because what it comes down to is, you know, one of the things that we usually say on the show when I do it is that this is about it's about creating a safe environment. And if someone feels safe, they're ultimately open up, you know, and share it. So as a therapist, how do you choose the modality off the top for this particular client that you may be working with?
Again, a lot of that is determined based on that first session with the information that has been shared. So if an individual sort of reports a history of trauma, be it sexual trauma or physical abuse, domestic violence, even exposure to community violence, those kinds of things cue me in to other issues that may be sort of playing in the background for them that we need to pay attention to. What I have found over the years, though, is that most of my clients really are dealing with faulty thought patterns, meaning that their way of sort of looking at the world and interpreting the world based on their past experiences have really shaped a way of thinking that is not helpful or not healthy. And so for a large percentage of my clients, I incorporate cognitive behavioral therapy techniques to help them to really understand and pay attention to their thinking. In fact, you know, I have a lot of clients that when they really get to understand and wrap their mind around how thoughts work in the brain and their ability to have some control over their thoughts, because a lot of people come in saying, like, I don't know how to turn it off. Like, is this happening? And it is. Thoughts are their automatic brain reflexes, but just like, you know, we have control over muscles and other things, we can learn to control our thoughts. And therefore, by learning to control our thoughts, we are able to impact our feelings or our mood, and then our behavior sort of follows suit. And so, you know, I give people examples like, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you get out of bed and you say, you know, today is going to be a good day. I'm determined it's going to be a good day. And you really start your day off like that. You typically find that you end up having a good day. If you wake up and you don't like your hair that particular day and you just say, this is just a bad day. My hair's not right. My outfit's not right. I don't feel good. You go to work. You're not going to be really friendly. You're not going to want to talk to anybody. And you end up having a day. You really begin to understand that, and they understand how the thought process works and how they can control it. And they understand the rewards and consequences associated with certain belief systems attached to their thoughts. They can really make some significant improvements in their mood and their behavior. I have some clients who come and say, man, I am exhausted this week because I didn't realize how negatively I thought until I started paying attention to it. And then when they try to work on changing those thoughts, it takes a lot of effort because they have spent so many years sort of thinking negatively about things. So that is a very, very common, typical way that I sort of approach my sessions with my clients. And then, you know, if there are attachment issues, I'll introduce some attachment theory. I'll introduce some positive thinking work. I'll introduce some work around forgiveness, those sorts of things. But generally, I find that most of my patients respond very favorably to the cognitive behavioral therapy approach.
So this, now that we've kind of laid the foundation, I think now this is good. We're ready to put our turn signal on and hit the turn. We talked about a little bit whether some may choose not to call it secrets because that can be can have a negative connotation, and I would agree with you there. There are many. I know my own story with my my mother. Her story was, I should say, I've experienced this watching that, where my grandmother, you know, for years had a story that she kept to herself, and mom found out about it many years later. And I say many years later, she was probably closer to 60 before she found out about this this information that my grandmother had been married before and had other children. And so she had to abandon those children in order to save her life. So she had to, you know, the story being told, she got out. Now, she felt, whatever reason, my grandmother felt for whatever reason, that she didn't want to share that with my uncle and my mother. And so for a while, you know, that was, that left a bit, I don't even want to say a bittersweet in my mom's mouth. That left a bitter taste in her mouth that this person who is her mother did not share this part of her life in her story. And so how do you deal with, when you take some type of situation like that, you know, it might be trauma. How do you approach that? And what would you tell a listener? Because I know many different stories and see, you know, that are secrets out there, whether it's adoption, whatever that it may be. I've got other friends who've had different experiences where for a minute of time, they, you know, it was their father wasn't their father. And so with that being said, how do you deal with that? How do you give them some coping techniques and mechanisms to help them kind of walk the walk and learn how to shift the thoughts?
So I think that my experience has been with the patients that I have worked with that the secrets or the things that have not been talked about from, you know, one generation to the next, that it basically over time begins to destroy from the inside out. And there's a lot of healing that has to come when people begin to talk about things that they haven't talked about. There's a whole lot of emotions that sort of get erupted that one has to deal with. And I really think my experience in that you don't work through it until you start dealing with it. And so, you know, initially individuals might be a little guarded, but what they find over time is that as they begin to talk about it more, as they take away the shame and the embarrassment and the guilt and all those other feelings, as they begin to peel all those layers back and really deal with the issues and try to understand, it sort of makes space for forgiveness. It makes space for healing. You don't have to feel like you have to carry this burden around. And so I think that that only happens. My experience has been with my own personal life and that of others that I work with, that it gets better once you start talking about it. It's when you keep it in the dark. It's when you keep it all bottled up inside that it's like this sort of brewing volcano. You just never know when it's going to erupt. And so talking about it really is when the healing begins, and it makes space for all of the other elements of forgiveness and so forth to sort of take root and to begin.
And that's a transition moment right here. We've got a caller, and I'm just seeing this. So, again, folks, if you want to call and ask the caller a question, the lines are open at 619-924-0869. And all you have to do is press 1. So, caller 570-431, you're live. Tell us your name and what your question or comment is for Nicole.
Hey, Chris. It's Debbie. How are you?
Hey, Debster. How are you?
I'm good. You know, this topic is so needed, and it's generational. I believe Nicole just talked about that a little bit. It is this living with secrets. It is handed down from generation to generation. You know, you don't talk about certain things. What happens in our family stays in our family, and then no one talks about it. And it's so funny, just this week I found this article why we don't keep secrets in our house. And the mother was telling a story about how some friends were over at the house, and she overheard one of her friends in the kitchen with her son. And the friend is giving the son an extra cookie, and the friend is saying to him, to the little boy, you know, this will be our secret. And the little boy says, oh, no, we don't keep secret in our house. We just have surprises. And so the woman was just laying out how they have developed this policy at home that we don't keep secrets from each other. And I just thought, you know what, how important is it for us to do this with our children? Because as we know, a lot of pedophiles and abusers, that's how they are able to, you know, hurt our children for so long, because of this notion of secrecy. It's a secret. Don't tell anyone. And so she said, even with little things, she encourages her child, you know, we don't keep secrets, because what people do, they start with little things like, okay, let me give you a cookie, it's our secret. And when the little boy keeps that secret, then you trust him with something a little bigger, until it gets to the point where there's either abuse or something else going on, and he's okay with keeping that secret. So we have to start changing the culture around secrets. And then, like Nicole just said as well, when you expose it, it loses its hold over you. But when you're covering it up, that's when it really has a hold of you. So, you know, excellent, excellent topic.
Well, thank you for sharing and for calling in. Nicole, you have any additional comments or questions for Nicole, feel free, call back, 619-924-0869.
Thank
Chris,
you.
Chris, I just want to add, I think that's an excellent point that she just made about, particularly with children, of the difference between secrets and surprises. Because, you know, I remember as a kid where you're throwing a surprise birthday party, but the word was, we got to keep this a secret. You know, we got to keep this a secret. So moving away from the idea of keeping secrets and keeping a surprise is totally different. And so I think that's excellent to use with small children. So I really appreciate that caller for sharing that point.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good. And in that same vein, we'll continue on. I want to throw this question out there for some of the listeners. So many people are thinking about this whole thing about the secret and all that, but I'm curious to know, what's the harm in keeping a secret from the mental, when you think about it from a mental, emotional, and psychological level, what's the harm in that?
So, you know, I think I touched on this a little bit before, but I want to add to that as well. So, you know, when you hold on to those things and you keep them inside, they really do fester. And they end up kind of growing, like things take on a new life. It becomes really big and difficult to manage when you hold onto it on the inside. And what we have learned is that our body works in a very interconnected kind of way. So there's no such thing as something is affecting you in one part of your body and your mood might not be affected by it. Like it, everything is interconnected and works together. So if you have something that you're holding on to, that you're keeping inside, that's causing you to feel sad or causing you to feel shame or causing you to feel guilt or embarrassment, those things are going to affect how you feel about yourself, how you feel about others. And not only that, it's going to affect one physically. There is more and more research coming out now that shows the connection between childhood traumas, experiences we have in life, our stress level, and our physical health. And so it's really important that we get a hold of these emotional and psychological issues because they're not just confined to the mind or to the heart in terms of our feelings, but they really do affect other parts of our body. There's an excellent book written by a doctor out of Orlando, Florida, Dr. Don Colbert, and it's called Deadly Emotions. And he really draws the link and the connection between our physical state and our emotional state. And he helps to really explain in pretty simple terms how stress and anxiety and anger and sadness and depression, that even though all of those feelings we all have them, they're all normal, but when we have them in excess, that they really do our body harm. And so individuals, in essence, create disease in their body based on carrying around all of this emotional stress based on things that they're holding secret and hostage in their lives.
Yeah, that's so true. I know there was Dr. Caroline Leaf who once stated that 80 to 84% of sickness starts in your thinking. You know, I thought, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, if you don't know that you're sick. There's a friend of mine who was telling me a story recently, and this person found out that they were sick. And then lo and behold, it just spiraled, you know, just like that. One thing led to the next. And now it's mental, now that I know that I'm sick. And so what happens is that we start feeling sick even more. And then we start acting out on the sickness. And it's amazing to me, the power of the human brain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give you a quick personal example with that. My grandmother, when she was, I don't know, she had to be probably well in her 70s. She might have even been a little bit older than that. She was living in Jamaica, and she ended up getting very sick, and it was determined that she had colon cancer. And so she had to have surgery, but her children decided that they were not going to tell her what was wrong. And she had the surgery at even that senior age, and she recovered, and she lived until she was 102. She might have even been 103. She just died a few years ago, and she did not know. She did not know. And she lived her life as if she were well because she did not know. And at times she would say, you know, she would try to get the information, I heard, or, you know, do you think this is what it is? And they had committed not to tell her. And so she did not live her life as a sick person who had cancer. So, I mean, that became very evident to me that the mind is very powerful in dictating and influencing illness and disease in our bodies.
Yeah, that's a good story to share. I think about, you know, when it comes to the mental part, these are the cousins, I refer to them. It's, one is guilt, one is shame, and then you got blame on the other end. I think they're first cousins. They ain't distant cousins. They're the first cousins. Usually you'll find shame hanging around guilt hanging around blame. But when you deal with patients, you know, in an environment as such, how much plays out that relates to you hear a lot of guilt? Because I think sometimes people do things in certain environments and situations because they feel guilted in doing it. And it's, I think it's a unconscious behavior, would you say? In some instances, it's like they say that 80% of what we do is controlled by our unconscious behavior. So sometimes we do things and we don't even realize it. But how much play do we find guilt and shame? And what is guilt? What is shame? How would you define that?
So I think that they do play out very much, and a lot of people present with feelings of guilt, shame, embarrassment, and blame is sort of always, you know, hanging around behind that. And it's really to help the person work through those feelings and to uncover what the thought process is behind the guilt and the shame. And most of the time when we really begin to unpack that, what I find is that it goes back to those faulty perceptions or belief systems that say that, you know, if someone knows this about me, I won't be lovable anymore. If someone knew this about me, I wouldn't be desirable anymore. If someone knew this about me, I would be isolated or ostracized. And so they have these belief systems that they're now using as their platform to interact with their environment, with their world. And so there are rewards to thinking that way, such as if I don't share, then they don't know they can't hurt me with their words. They can't reject me with their attitude or their interactions. But there are also consequences to that, in that you end up feeling isolated, or you end up feeling lonely, or you end up feeling sad, or you end up feeling rejected. And so it becomes a choice around, do the rewards really protect you, or does it actually create more consequences, more negative feelings in thinking this way? And typically, if we're really able to change those faulty foundational thought patterns, belief systems about how they're perceived by others, how others will respond and interact with them, it takes the power away from the guilt and the shame. And it really leaves people liberated and feeling like, this is not something that has to hold me down. This is not something that has to, you know, hold me prisoner for the rest of my life, but that you can live free and that, you know, you don't have to have the shame and the guilt attached to that. So I think it really starts with going deeper to the core of what's causing the one to feel the guilt and the shame.
Yeah, one of the things I say before is that a lot of times we try to take a surface solution and try to, we take a root issue and apply a surface solution to it. So in other words, if you try to kill a dandelion, you cut the grass, not going to kill the dandelion until you kill it at the root. And so we got to focus on the root issue of it. And until we get to the core of it, you know, Bishop Jakes would always say, get to the core. Who are you at your core so that you can be at your highest and best use? And so I think that this is important to note. And I'm an advocate that prayer works. But I'm even an advocate as well on the other side that we can't pray everything away. Okay, so in essence, but I think it's important to know, and I go on record in saying this, that I remember when Paul cast out the demons, but Paul was operating in his spiritual gift. And so what the listeners have to know, that some of you are thinking, you know, I can pray away. No, you get help. That's the whole purpose of it. One of the church that I go to is First Baptist Church of Glen Arden. And we try to, you know, under the direction of Pastor John Kenneth Jenkins, we just had a health symposium this past weekend, was, you know, bringing information for the seniors and the youth and all of that to our community. They brought the information with doctors and experts in the area and study so that we could be better from a holistic approach. The mental side of things is significant as well, and this is what Nicole does is so imperative. It is, to me, a priority in our community, and I'm not just talking about the African-American community. I am speaking on a broader scope that it is important because right now what we see, and I want to pause for just a moment for all those who lost loved ones and the heinous act of violence once again that we've seen done in the face of this nation that just happened a couple nights ago in Orlando. But what we noticed, Nicole, I wrote a post, excuse me, I wrote something probably a year or so titled Suffering in Silence. And one of the things that I noticed when I did my, you know, took a little bit of statistics and a little bit of data, and I made a statement that it majority of the time what we see in these acts, these are men committing these crimes. From the very beginning of Columbine on down, these are men, and there's a certain demographical age that it is. And I believe that until we treat the root issue, as we were talking about, of the thing, we're always going to have to fix it on the surface. That surface is not going to take care of it. So having said that, I think it's important for us to really get to the root of it. And many people, again, going back to the storyline of the family secret, they feel it's important to protect something. So, Nicole, what are we really protecting? For those, are we, some may think, well, I'm protecting them. Are you really? Or are you protecting yourself? So what's your take on it, Nicole?
You know, I don't stand in judgment to anyone around why they do what they do. Around some not big issues. I'm not talking about people who are killing people. I'm not talking about stuff like that. I'm talking about, you know, why you didn't tell someone that this person was their father, or because I don't necessarily know all the details around why certain information may not have been shared. So, you know, sometimes people keep information to themselves because they believe genuinely in their heart that they are trying to, that they're protecting the other person. Maybe in some ways they're selfishly protecting themselves. Perhaps that may not be at the forefront of their decision, or it may be. I think there's no way to really sort of determine that without having a conversation with the person. And that's what it really gets down to. I mean, we're talking about, you know, these things have to come out of the shadows, out of the darkness, and folks have conversations about them. That's what removes the shame and the guilt. That's what removes the stigma. That's what removes the pain, when we can start talking about it, because it gives us opportunity to understand the other person. When we don't talk about it, we don't understand. We don't know what the other person's thinking was. We don't know why they kept it a secret. And that leads us to all kinds of assumptions that we know could be completely off base or completely misinterpreted or just completely wrong. You know, so we have to have conversations about this to figure out what is the real story and why did it go the way that it went.
Yeah, and I think that's so important that you, as you say, talk about it. So let's talk about that. how do you talk about it when all you know is related to the story in your head? A couple of years back, I used to do workshops on beliefs and behaviors, beliefs and values. And for many of you who you've never heard me say this, I always say beliefs and values control behavior, because the way you believe, what you believe, is controls what you do. What you do is based on what you believe. Until it's challenged or contested. So, for instance, you know, I grew up believing that there was a Santa Claus. I grew up believing there was a Tooth Fairy and Easter Bunny. However, that was a belief that was passed down to me. It was a fallacy until I learned truth. So it's significant depending on what your truth is. So how, Nicole, do we teach truth to someone out there who doesn't know, but they may be open? And I guess that's another thing. There has to be a level, as you stated, of willingness to come to the table, to sense the new truth is, and be willing to put down, you know, your weapons of warfare, if you will, whether it's, you know, he did this, she did that, the push and the blame, and really sit down and let's try to understand what's really going on from the root issue. So how do we have that conversation?
I think that if you have parties who are willing to engage in a conversation, That's the easy part. I think what is most challenging for my clients is when they want to talk about it and the other person does not. And then that becomes really about, so how do I move on and how do I live without answers, without explanations, without the discussion to help me understand why this happened the way that it did. I think those are the more difficult conversations to have because people have to figure out how to live their lives without necessarily having the whole truth or all the facts. And so that is sort of a little different than when people want to come to the table and have a conversation. I think folks are coming to the table and wanting to talk about it again. I think it creates the space for understanding different points of view. It creates the space for healing.
Yeah, and that's an important piece. And it is a really difficult thing. And I'll say from experience, it is so difficult to really face the fact that you may not get the truth. And that's a question that I have for tonight's show, Nicole. So once a secret is shared, let's say, you know, what do you recommend? How do you mend it back together? You said talking about it. What are some of the other approaches that we could take?
You got to give it time. It takes time. Many of these things are spanning an individual's lifetime, you know, their entire lives. And so just in one conversation doesn't necessarily resolve it. So it does take time. There's many different ways to talk about things. You know, individuals write letters, they write poets, they do artwork. I know some individuals who use dance as their mode of expression. There are many different ways that one can begin to sort of heal and go through the process of sort of mending relationships in healing their own hurts and their own pain. They may change their relationship with loved ones in their lives. They may make decisions or commitments or pledges to live a different type of life. And so all of that is sort of wrapped up into the healing process and what it looks like. For a number of my patients, the question comes up a lot around forgiveness and how do you do that? I think conceptually most people understand that forgiveness is a necessary component of relationships, but don't know how to forgive. And so I try to talk, you know, folks through the idea that first you have to start by expressing the emotion. You have to talk about it. You have to start having the conversation about the hurt and the emotion and everything that goes into that. And then after that, generally people want to understand why. And the why may not always make sense. It may not be the why that they want, but there needs to be some sort of satisfaction in the mind that there is some understanding of what happened. And then after that understanding happens, there really is a decision to work towards letting go and rebuilding safety. And all of those things don't necessarily happen in a very linear way. You may flow from one to the other, but when you get to the decision of letting go, it's really the person who is the victim, the person who has been harmed by the secret or the transgression, who makes a decision. It really is a decision. You have to make a decision that you're going to equal the playing field between yourself and the transgressor, that you're not going to hold on to it, that you're going to let it go. But that typically does not happen well until you have gone through the emotional expression, gaining some level of understanding of why it happened, rebuilding some safety and trust in the relationship, and then letting go.
Yeah, that is some of the hardest stuff to really do. And one of the listeners had a question and posted is, so when you have a secret with someone who's now deceased, and that secret is revealed, how can you know, how can a person move forward from this without holding resentment towards them in their heart, without knowing their intent or motive or keeping the secret? And I know you mentioned a minute ago that you may not understand their why, if you will. It may not make sense. You mentioned that it may not be linear in that process. But now this person is deceived. How do you teach a client to handle that?
That's interesting, because I'm actually working with a patient on this right now. And I'm working with her more on forgiving herself and not so much the deceased person, because there's so many unanswered questions that she has for that individual that chances are she may not be able to get all of them answered. But she herself carries around so much guilt and so much shame attached to that secret that she may feel like she's lost part of her life sort of holding on to this and carrying this around now. And so it's really helping her to live now with the answers and the questions that she still has, and to not hold on to it and feel like she has to be hostage. So learning to even forgive herself for time lost, you know, in keeping the secret, taking away the shame. And even though she can't address it with the person who wronged her, but being able to talk to others about it and not feel like she still has to carry this burden all by herself. So sometimes when that individual is not there, whether they're deceased or you're not able to reach them for whatever reason, it's helping the individual figure out how they're going to function and how they're going to forgive themselves for holding on to it for as long as they have.
I think that's so significant. We used to say forgiveness is more about you than it is about them. And I think once we come to the conclusion of that, that'll help us to kind of move forward with the scars that are there. And I always tell people this. There's a cut that I have on my leg. I'll never forget that cut. I can recall the exact moment that it happened. But what I can do now is make a choice that I don't have to relive it. And so, yes, it hurt at the time. But now I don't have to go back through the emotional, mental, and the psychological trauma that's connected with that. And here's the thing that many people don't realize, Nicole, is that when you go back to that point of that fear or the immediate pain, you start reliving that thing all over again. What's the harm in that?
There's lots of harm. I mean, the brain, I recently read, I can't remember if it was an article or book, but I was recently reading something, and it was talking about how the brain does not register between a past experience and a current experience. And that's often why an individual who has been through some sort of negative experience or some sort of traumatic event, that when they recall it, that they will sort of feel the emotions as if it's happening right there. So I liken it to, you know, if you've watched some of these like Law and Order shows and what have you, if you work in that type of field and you've interviewed or talked to people who have experienced rape or molestation or some other sort of, you know, serious trauma or any kind of trauma for that matter, and they start talking about it, sometimes you'll hear like the rapid pace in their voice or the shortness in their breathing, because in some ways they're almost sort of recalling those same feelings by talking about it. However, that typically occurs when there hasn't been any resolution around the trauma. When you work through it, you're able to talk about it without necessarily recalling all of the hurt feelings once you've worked through some of those issues. And it doesn't mean that you talk about it sort of at length. And, you know, I say to some of my clients that have experienced some really, really difficult situations that, you know, we talk about it to a place of healing, to a place of healthy functioning. We don't talk about it to sort of never have it end, because then it's re-traumatizing the victim all over again. So it's finding that balance between how much you talk about it to the point where an individual can come to some acceptance about some things and move on to a healthier place of functioning.
Awesome. Well, here, let's talk about some closing questions as we prepare to bring this thing in to an end here. Nicole, now, we talked briefly about this. We touched about the different communities and many communities, and particularly the African-American community, as we are kind of known or stigmatized, really don't believe in talking about it. And that may be also known as a generational thing. We talked about the generational patterns or pathologies that, well, we just don't talk about that. That's not something we're going to talk or bring up. And so from an outsider, we're not going to share that with an outsider. Now, when I say outsider, I'm referring to maybe that person, a therapist, a counselor, a pastor. Those are some examples of outsiders. So, Nicole, if you had to tell them in one sentence or less, what would you say to them? If this is their belief, what would you say to challenge that belief?
I would say that, you know, if it's swollen or hurting and you're in pain, you go to the doctor and you talk about it. Well, it's no different between the mind and the heart, or what we associate with our feelings, that when it hurts, when you know it's not working like it should, you need to talk to somebody. And we need to have more platforms like this. And, you know, in our communities, in our churches, in our schools, where we communicate that it's okay to talk to someone when something isn't working like you know it should, or something is hurting when you know it's not supposed to hurt the way that it's hurting. We've got to get it out there that just like you would talk to your doctor, or you would go see, you know, a specialist for an issue with your heart or something, it's also necessary to see someone if you have matters concerning the emotions or the mind.
Yeah, and I'll sum it up for you. I think that's well said. I'm going to give you just a colloquialism, if you will. Talk through the issues so that you don't have to walk through the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So just remember it that way. The issue that you don't talk about will be the problem that you cry about later, and you'll wonder, why am I crying over this thing? Why is this bothering me? Now, I'll throw this out there just as a nugget and always say many of us have daddy pains. There have been many, and that's a whole other show in itself that we'd come back for to address. But for men as well as for women, the issue that you don't address with daddy creates the issue that you'll have with the man in many instances later, because now, you can back me up on this, Nicole, or you can go to the left on this, but for many instances that are out there, and there are some statistics that show for men as well as women who never had the model of a man for a man to see how a man should lead, guide, protect, and profess, and then for a woman who never had her first hero that was there, that creates sometimes trauma later on for the man who comes along, because he always has to live the fairy tale that he can never fulfill the dream. You follow
mm-hmm.
me?
Yes.
So I just kind of wanted to throw that little nugget out there. I think it's important to sit down and have that conversation with a professional like Nicole, and that's a perfect segue into, Nicole, what can a person expect when they consult with a mental health professional? So how much time will it take? How long before they see transformation? What can they expect?
So, you know, that really does depend on the individual. It depends on what their particular diagnosis is and, you know, what sort of symptomology they may be presenting with. Depends on whether or not, you know, an individual needs medication or not, or they don't need medication. There are a number of factors that go into that. For the average person that may not have some severe symptoms or some severe mood or thought sort of processing cognitive mental health issues, you know, I tell my patients generally to let's sort of hang in there for about 6 to 8 weeks. Initially, I ask them to commit to at least 4 to 6 weeks of weekly sessions, and that's partly because, you know, we're building rapport. Trust doesn't happen overnight. You have to build that relationship, and, you know, we're spending 45 minutes to 1 hour a week together, and so that takes a little bit of time to get someone really comfortable. And so I ask them to sort of commit to that up front. And then at the 6 to 8 week mark, we evaluate together sort of where we are, you know, if they feel good about sort of what's been happening in terms of how they've been feeling. And then we adjust accordingly. You know, if we need to keep going at every week, we do that. If we need to sort of adjust down and scale back, I think that can happen then. It's important for the individual to really feel involved in that process. I think people want to feel a sense of competency, a sense of capacity to function independently, that they don't have to rely on a therapist to help them process their thoughts or feel better. And so having the client really involved in that process through what their treatment looks like really serves well in the long run for an individual to really sort of set their own goals around what does transformation look like, you know, what does healthy emotional living look like for them, and then together we kind of figure that out.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important here. And so, you know, for folks that understand, we're not talking about self-medication. This is a process in order to go through this and really to be healthy, whole, for whether it's, you know, you're trying to be, as we started in the beginning of the show, to live better, love deeper, and laugh more. So hopefully you've heard something tonight on tonight's show that you've heard from Nicole Wright about getting right from the inside out with the healing hands. And so, Nicole, give me your information. So if someone wants to contact you, you know, tomorrow or tonight via email or whatever, how can they reach you? What's your website information? What's your contact information if they want to consult with you about future conversations about them getting right with themselves?
Absolutely. So I can be reached on, I'll give my phone number first and then I'll provide a website, but I can be reached on 301-202-4814. That's 301-202-4814. You can also visit my website at www.giftedhandswellness.com. Center, all one word, giftedhandswellnesscenter.org. If you want to shoot me email, you can send it to giftedhandswellnessctr@gmail.com. You can also find me on Psychology Today by looking in the Lanham area or putting my name in the search bar, Nicole Wright, and that will provide all my contact information there as well that I just provided.
Yeah, that's awesome, guys. And I want to say firsthand that when you talk with Nicole, you will be definitely truly blessed from what your journey will entail. Closing comments, anything that you want to share for the listeners, Nicole?
I just want to thank you, Chris, for being invested in having these kinds of conversations and creating a platform, an audience where I'm sure that there are individuals who are listening and they're saying to themselves, you know, this is my story. This sounds like me. I've been hurting for a long time and wasn't really sure what to do, how to get started, even how to make the first phone call, how to find a therapist. I mean, I hear that all the time. I've never done this before. I didn't know where to start. I don't know what to ask. And so, you know, you asking these questions really creates an environment that says it's okay that we can talk about this and that, you know, we get better when we begin to take some action, and getting some help is taking action. So I want to thank you for the invite to be on your show. I appreciate all the thought that you have put into the questions and those that have come from callers and the comment that we got from the caller earlier. This is so important, and I'm just really grateful to have been asked to be a part of this discussion, of this conversation, and help us out there. And they're great therapists that are out there who care about people, who want to help, and who believe, as I do, that it's a personal calling and ministry that has been placed on my life, and I'm doing my best to walk in it and to please God in the process. So I just thank you again for this opportunity.
It has certainly been my pleasure and my treat tonight, and you are gifted with the hands that you have. God has blessed you. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the end to our show tonight. I want to thank you all for listening and tuning in. And all I want to say to you is this. It begins with you, and it ends with you. So if you don't change, nothing else will about your situation. So that has been it for our show. You can listen to it again on our replay that we'll have on the website, realtalkwithchrisrichardson.com. Tell a friend, tell a neighbor. I think this is a significant show, and you don't want to miss it, the information that was shared. So go back and listen to it again. Again, contact and reach out to Nicole if you've got questions on about therapy or just talking through some issues. Talking is healthy. The problem is that we are in a culture now that's starting to suffer in silence, and we're not talking anymore. We're picking up weapons of mass destruction, and we're taking our issues out and making our issues become somebody else's problems. It does not have to be that way. So thank you all for listening again. Good night. God bless. And we'll see you next week for another show on the Real Talk with Chris Richardson Show. Thanks, Nicole.
Thanks, Chris.
Good night.
Good night.